Welcome to a special edition of Path to Zero, recorded from the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit in New York City. Now, here's your host, Tucker Perkins.
One of the great things about being in New York for the Reuters Global Energy Transition Summit is being close to the incredible experts in climate and sustainability at the Columbia University Climate School. We're fortunate to welcome Dr. Lisa Dale, an expert in sustainable development, and we're going to talk to her about her book, Climate Change Adaptation. Thanks so much for joining us today, Dr. Dale.
Thanks for having me, Tucker.
We got so much we're going to talk about. It's really one of my favorite topics that we rarely talk about is adaptation. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about your book. But let's start with you and your work at Columbia and maybe even how you got to writing this book.
Sure. So my background includes time spent out in Colorado, where I worked both in academia and I worked in politics for a long time for state government. I've been at Columbia now for just finished up my sixth year there. And my research is on climate change adaptation, and I study that in two very different types of landscapes. I study wildfire policy in the American West, quite fitting for the air quality we're experiencing today in New York City. And I do research as well in sub-Saharan Africa. Most recently, I've been working in Rwanda now for a number of years, and I study rural development in Rwanda. Both of these settings, wildfire policy in the American West and rural smallholder farmers in Rwanda, you can ask some of the same questions about how these different communities are being affected by climate change, how policies are being crafted designed to help them adapt to climate change, how well those policies are working. So that sort of unites for me thematically these very different areas of inquiry that have guided me throughout my career. The book itself is part of a series of books called the Earth Institute Primer Series. And I think my book is the maybe fifth or sixth, I'm not sure, in the series. And they're designed to give the scientists at the Earth Institute, now part of the Climate School — the Climate School is brand new, but these are still the Earth Institute Primer Series — to give scientists from the Earth Institute an opportunity to explain complicated and technical and scientific topics for a lay audience, hence the Primer Series. It's exactly the kind of writing that I really love to do, which is what I do in the classroom. Take really complicated ideas that we talk about in closed rooms and bring it to a way that can be understood by anybody. So I was really happy to contribute to the series on my area of expertise, which is climate change adaptation.
It was a really well done book. And I think in the book, you frequently make the point that climate change is very much a global issue, but as we talk about adaptation, it's very much a local issue. Talk about, maybe expand on that and tell us why that's so important.
Yeah, I think it's really foundational to understand that as a starting point. So for climate change mitigation efforts, which is, you know, when we think about climate change policy, we can divide that into two categories: mitigation and adaptation. On the mitigation side, we're interested in reducing emissions across a variety of strategies and approaches. But me reducing one ton of carbon that I emit is functionally equivalent to you emitting, reducing an emission in Texas, or somebody reducing an emission in Bangladesh. And so it serves to unite in some ways this global community because we have a shared atmosphere. One ton of carbon is one ton of carbon, no matter where it is emitted. And so we have to sort of work together globally to address this problem because it's everybody's problem definitionally. And that creates a number of components of the climate change policy regime on the mitigation side, including an ongoing focus on global political cooperation. It has led to the development of a number of complicated financial instruments that have to do with carbon credits and emissions trading. Because again, I can trade you one ton of carbon for one ton of carbon. It doesn't matter where that's happening. But adaptation doesn't function this way. Adaptation is really place-based and local. Here we are in New York City with catastrophically bad air quality. Our ability to adapt to that here and now is really on us, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody in Bangladesh has nothing to do with this. So it shifts the way we think about the role of policy, the role of policymakers, and how funding might travel to support some of these adaptation needs.
You know, let's stick with wildfires just for a moment, because I think it's interesting that that's an area of expertise of yours. And the wildfires we see in California, but even, you know, I remember the most recent ones in Colorado happened to be there right afterwards, horribly impactful for air quality, horribly impactful in terms of generating CO2 into the atmosphere. Do you, and people so often blame that on climate change. Do you think that wildfires particularly, is that really a function of climate change, less rain, drought, whatever, or is it more about policies and practices around timber management?
Well, I don't think it has. Okay, I think that's a great question, and there's some pieces of that we can unpack. Wildfires have happened since the beginning of time, right? Long before we had any ability to detect a climate change signal, and I think I would argue long before climate change was really impacting our atmosphere. Wildfires occur because the forests need them. They're called fire-dependent forests.
And generally so, started by lightning, right? Generally?
80% of wildfires are started by humans, usually accidentally. But yes, lightning is an ignition source for sure. And across the West, as when there were fewer humans, most of the fires did start naturally. But wildfire is critical and essential for forest health, for ecosystem viability. The problem arises when more and more people move into these fire-dependent forests, and now we have an untenable situation because we have human beings and properties and assets of value right in the way of forests that have always burned and will always burn. To the climate change question, I think the data is pretty clear that climate change is influencing the pattern of wildfire behavior. I wouldn't say climate change is responsible for wildfires because we've always had wildfires. But without question, climate change is contributing to more fires, larger fires, more catastrophic fires, more intense fires, and more costly fires. And so tackling wildfire is, in that way, a really interesting example of climate change adaptation. Because living in the West, you have to adapt to living in a fire-based ecosystem anyway. We were talking about fire-safe communities decades ago out West. But now we can think about, okay, what we know about climate change is that these fires are getting worse, are likely to continue to get worse, and so adaptation has to look different. This isn't going to continue. This is not your grandfather's wildfire.
And notice we live in a time now where the second insurer, I guess, pulled out of California this week. They're mainly around fire concern, but we certainly see it in the Southeast, insurers rethinking their presence around storms, tornadoes, hurricanes mainly. Do you think that's a classic example where we're just living in places that maybe we shouldn't live, or is it more that we're not building homes to the standards we should build them to?
I'm hesitant to say that we're living in places we shouldn't live. I think certainly coastlines are increasingly inhabitable, and we may want to rethink our civilizational tendency to situate our largest megacities on coastlines, right? That made a lot of sense in a pre-climate change world, but part of adaptation is saying, okay, we now live in a different world, it's got a different climate, and being near a port is a little bit less important when also sea level rise threatens the viability of setting up civilization and centers of commerce in those locations. The reason I hesitate to say people are living in the wrong places is we're kind of running out of places, right? You can't live on the coast. You can't live in the mountains. Maybe the cities aren't safe. Here we are with smoke in eastern Pennsylvania. Isn't that safe, right? So climate change is affecting everybody everywhere and will continue to affect everybody everywhere. I think we will see and are seeing, as you say, sustained movements of population centers, and we're just starting to see that. I think there's a lot of evidence to suggest that that's going to increase in the future as some of these risks become more and more untenable. And insurance, your initial question, I think insurance plays a really critical role in this dynamic. We sometimes think about the insurance industry as being a pure source of risk assessment. That's their business, right? Mm-hmm. They have to accurately identify potential financial risk and then monetize it and remain profitable. And so we might imagine, and in many cases it's true, I think, that the insurance companies and the insurance industry provides us with a glimpse of real risk that's a little bit free of politics, right? And it's free of culture. It's just an assessment of the data, and it's an algorithm that they're using to determine premium rates. And so when a company like State Farm, pulls out of California, an otherwise very lucrative market, I think it's attention getting. It suggests to me that something in the math problem has shifted for them, and it is no longer viable for them to be there. That's a really valuable reflection of risk, and we might hope that insurance functions to reveal to us as homeowners or renters what the risk is that we face. The problem is, in many cases, like the southeast of the U.S., which you asked about, those insurance payments are now underwritten by the federal government, and so it's muddied, right? Mm-hmm. We're not paying our actual risk when we pay a premium for flood insurance in Miami. We're paying a heavily subsidized version of the risk, and so it's clouded for us. If we live in Miami, you think, well, am I at risk here? I live on a coastal city, and then you think, well, my home insurance is pretty cheap. It must not be that bad, right? So it serves to as misguiding information when the insurance rates remain really low. Now, on the other side, we could raise a lot of concerns about escalating insurance rates or vanishing insurance companies, because we pretty quickly end up in a situation where only the wealthiest people can afford insurance, which means either everybody's living in these highly risky settings without any buffer, without any safety net, or it means people who can't afford those higher costs of insurance have to leave. Right. And then only rich people get to live in the mountains. And this doesn't feel quite right to us either. So I think insurance is quite complicated.
What a great answer. I knew that question had a lot in it, but what a great answer. Thanks. Well, let's move to now talk about kind of the general points in your book around adaptation. And the first thing I notice is, as a person who's really intimately involved in this transformation, if you would, very few people are talking about adaptation. Most people are talking about the risks, but very few people, and the only few voices that I do hear, they're like, it's time to start talking about adaptation. We're going to see a need to talk about adaptation and to, in fact, adapt. So you talk about that in the book, but kind of talk about why so few voices seem to want to have the uncomfortable conversation about it's time to talk about adaptation.
I think it is quite tricky. For a long time, since, in the last 20 years, we've had fits and starts of these global treaty efforts to get our arms around climate change and try to mitigate climate change. And in that setting, and the way the challenge has been framed for everybody, is that climate mitigation is our challenge. And if we start thinking about adapting, it's an admission of failure. It's an admission that we did not succeed in mitigating. And so adaptation has always been sort of a second-tier issue at most of these global conferences. It's been a second-tier issue in climate finance settings and in all kinds of political and policymaking settings. I think that is changing, and changing quickly. I go to the annual climate change conference called the COP every year, and over the years that I've been attending, the visibility of the adaptation theme has dramatically grown. Until this last year, we were in Egypt, and I think it was almost 50-50, where a lot more countries now are talking about prioritizing, thinking about, and trying to generate resources to support their climate adaptation needs. Part of the reason for that is it's unavoidable at this point. We are all adapting every day. When I walked over here to meet with you and I put on a mask because I was trying to block that air quality from reaching my lungs, that's an adaptation strategy, right? I'm adapting to impacts from climate change by taking some protective action. When I just do that as an individual person, we call that autonomous adaptation. And it's maybe functional for me in the 10 minutes it took me to walk through the streets to get here. But when we think about adaptation policy, now we're thinking about what roles can governments play in facilitating adaptation, in maximizing outcomes from adaptation. Can we subsidize masks for days when we have bad health outcomes? Can we improve communication with the public about air quality and connections to climate change? And so those are the types of adaptation policies now that I think are getting a lot more attention and people are starting to think about.
Thanks. In the book, you talk about something that really I never read about before, is managed retreat, and about getting people to actually get away from the risk. And I don't mean in the heat of the moment with the impending hurricane or the wildfire that's outside their community, but literally to make the long-term decision to move, to transform their life. Talk about, I love the human factor as part of this whole conversation. Again, rarely ever talked about how people are so resistant to do something that might appear obvious to a scientist. Talk about managed retreat.
Yeah, so managed retreat refers to a specifically government-driven, so an external force coming in and managing the entirety of a community retreating out of harm's way. That's kind of the textbook definition of managed retreat. But if we step back from that and we think about migration and human movements across the landscape, we certainly know that this has happened since the beginning of time and continues to happen, right? People always leave settings when their livelihoods cannot be satisfied there. So people leave areas when there is persistent drought, and they migrate. They may migrate internally within their country. They may migrate overseas. We run into some difficulties with immigration policies and the politics around immigration. These all have to do with some version of managed retreat, and many of those people who are moving are doing so because of climate change impacts that have made their initial location non-viable, and so they move. But again, just like what we were talking about, when one household, one individual, or even a few relocate, we don't necessarily call that managed retreat, we just might call that migration, right? But when we start reframing this to think about the way these movements could be coordinated, could be led by a government, could be supported financially and with other resources to maximize better outcomes, moving is really disruptive and disorienting for any family, then we start thinking about maybe some best practices for managed retreat as a policy choice, as an intentional policy choice. I think you're right that people in general are quite reluctant to move. And some of that is for good reason, right? We relocate when the situation is desperate. We relocate when we cannot get work, when we don't feel safe, when we cannot grow food. These are reasons that humans have moved since the beginning of time. But staying in place is also a really important and culturally and socially important urge to stay still. We have social bonds and social cohesion. Our family and our friends live nearby. We know how to navigate the city or the town where we live. Relocating us, whether we move to get a better job or move for to be able to grow crops, suddenly we don't have a social network anymore. We don't have support. And those things also matter for our ability to adapt to climate change. So it's not always true. In fact, I think it's rarely true that the scientists somehow are sitting here thinking, oh, if only all those people would move away from the coast. I just don't think that's either viable or desirable. Where are they going to go? How is that going to benefit them? How is that going to benefit, right, you know, the country? So managed retreat is quite complicated.
And the system is set up for them to rebuild in place, do it again, and you see it time and time again. Tornadoes that routinely come through places, they rebuild. Hurricanes that routinely impact places, they rebuild. And so you just see that this is, as you said, it's where, it's my home, this is my community, this is where I've been, and repeat, repeat, repeat.
Yeah, and we attach, you know, value and bravery to those decisions. We say, you're going to fight and return and not give up and not retreat. You know, the word retreat sounds like failure, doesn't it? And so we really culturally celebrate fighting it out and remaining true to your town. And after every natural disaster, you know, the mayor of the town gets on TV and says, we're resilient, we're going to come back. You know, and to your point, we might think, well, is that really the best solution? And I think we may see, and we are seeing, some changes specifically to the policies and incentives that drive those kinds of behaviors. So for example, the flood insurance program in the southeast of the U.S. requires people who've lost their homes to flooding to rebuild on the same site using the same building materials.
Right.
It's absurd, right? That's patently absurd.
The system is stacked that way.
And that program is now bankrupt as a result. So some of those types of policies can be changed, will be changed, I think. Some policies in some other countries, in some other parts of the U.S. even have a twice and out rule, where if you rebuild twice and get burned down again or flooded again, you know, you're not allowed to rebuild there. And so there's ways to tinker with incentives to galvanize more strategic movements around the landscape. That's, I think, something shy of full-scale managed retreat, but still amounts to putting a finger on the scale a little bit in some strategic places.
You know, we're here in New York at the Reuters meeting, and really we've talked a lot about how to work through climate. We really have not talked much about adaptation, and really, as I think about it, we didn't really talk a lot about equity or justice, which is terms I find are used so broadly. You actually address both equity and justice, or really, to your point, inequality. We kind of see, and I'm really interested in your worldview here, but I would argue that many of those least able to make a change are often most affected. They live near a power plant. They live in the undesirable places near the port. Talk about how adaptation, and bring all that together for us, the underserved, if you will, adaptation, justice. How do we put all that together, and how do we do the right thing there?
Yeah, this is a tough one. I mean, as a starting point, we live in an unequal and inequitable world. Some people live with great wealth and abundance. Others live scraping by and subsistence livelihoods, if we take a global view. Anytime a hazard arrives on any city or any community, the people who are already suffering the most will experience the greatest harm. Now, the hazard is the same, right? There's a hurricane. That is untouched. And what differentiates the caliber of impact that people experience usually depends on two other variables that we call exposure and vulnerability. And those are things we have some ability to tinker with. So exposure, right, if you live on the coastline in a straw hut, you're highly exposed to that hurricane that's coming in. Your neighbor might live in a brick house with a solid foundation. They're less exposed, right? But you're still neighbors. The hazard is still the same. But we can say the person in the brick house is probably going to do better in this hurricane because they have lowered their exposure through building materials or building construction. We also look at vulnerability, which I talk about in my book as being the pre-existing social and economic conditions of a household or a community. So again, if we look at these two neighbors on the coastline, you know, in this approaching hurricane, one household has a job that can be done remotely. This household also has access to unemployment insurance, and this household is maybe also comprised of people who are in generally good health and mobile. The other household is comprised of people who work on frontline jobs that cannot be shifted to a remote setting. Maybe somebody has pre-existing health conditions or two. Maybe somebody is older, unable to be mobile. That second household, same hazard. When that hurricane arrives, if their lives are disrupted, the damage will be much more severe long-term, more costly, and more difficult for them to come back from. They don't have social supports. They have health problems. We can easily see that family, the second family, much more vulnerable. And so they stand to be much more grievously harmed by the same hazard. Modifying vulnerability is the ticket. And so we can't modify the hazard. We can modify the hazard in some larger sense, right? If we successfully mitigate climate change, maybe 100 years from now, hurricane strengths reduce. But that's not viable in the face of the hurricane. What we can do is focus on vulnerability. And we can do that by embracing this sort of larger world of social policy and social buffers, and provide more people with insurance products that allow them to be out of work for some period of time in the face of a disaster. We might think about better healthcare as suddenly being relevant here as a climate adaptation attribute, because if you have access to better healthcare, you're less sick, you're more mobile, and you're maybe better able to manage that kind of a hazard. So in my work, I think focusing on vulnerability and ahead of time, far ahead of any kind of climate impact, is the most productive way for me to think about how to address issues of equity and justice. Because it's foundationally inequitable that one neighbor has so much better access to these sorts of social supports and systems than the next door neighbor, right? So those are the inequities we can target through policy.
Is it significantly different as you think about communities in Colorado and you think about communities you deal with in Africa? Is it a completely, because the support networks are so different?
At first look, it is completely different, right? There's not one commonality between a small rural village in Rwanda where 90% of the residents of this village are subsistence farmers and don't have access even to irrigated fields. They can only grow and live on what they can grow on their tiny plots. That's the reality in Rwanda. Then I go to, you know, Colorado and look at how people who live in the wildland urban interface in the mountains are adapting to wildfire. And you think, well, these are, you know, mutually exclusive types of settings. But there are many, I think, thematic strands that tie these two disparate communities together when we start thinking about them as both contending with climate change adaptation needs. So one way to think about this is by thinking about what we call adaptive capacity. And that's a little bit just what it sounds like, which is the capacity to adapt. What do you need to be able to adapt to whatever climate change is handing you? Mm-hmm. And if you're a farmer, a subsistence farmer in Rwanda, maybe you need irrigation. Maybe you need different seeds that will help your crops grow in these changed conditions. Maybe you need access to fertilizer, which maybe means you need access to credit.
Sorry.
It's okay. Credit to be able to buy fertilizer, that these types of adaptation strategies will improve your adaptive capacity. You're better able to adapt to a drought year if you can still eat while right. you're waiting for the drought to pass, right? And so to do that, that enhances your adaptive capacity, better seeds, irrigation, et cetera. In Colorado, what you might need to adapt to wildfire is different, but you're still building your adaptive capacity. You might need technical support to understand how to change the building materials on your roof so you're less flammable. You still need financial support. You still need credit. You still need technical help. And you're still trying to build your adaptive capacity to allow you to live in an area that faces hazards and to be less vulnerable to those hazards. So thematically, they're shockingly similar, even though the setting and the reality is so different.
Is there a shining example worldwide? You can go anywhere you want, of how government is supporting adaptation?
I think there's lots and lots and lots of examples. I have two that I will briefly share. One is, I just got back from a trip to visit family in Amsterdam, and I was in Amsterdam for the week, and could not help but notice the incredible efforts that happen across the Netherlands to manage sea level rise. This is a country that is built entirely under sea level, right? And so they've been developing a complicated system of polders and water systems and pumps and dikes and for generations. Now that system that they have is perhaps the world's greatest example of how to manage water in a changing climate. That's adaptation. And the government supports it, and the public is seemingly really bought into it. There's a lot of cultural support for it. And so that's an example. Now, is that an example we could replicate in other places? I'm not sure. I think the Dutch example.
Miami has tried to, I think.
They've tried.
They know all about that system. They just cannot figure out how to actually execute it, either for land use or cost or whatever.
There's a lot of reasons why the Dutch system is not something they can easily export, but it's an interesting success story to look at the various components in government ministries and social systems that allow that to function so well, that has allowed that country to thrive in a changing climate. So that's one example. The other example I'll have to pull is from Rwanda, where I've been doing a lot of my research there. And what the government of Rwanda has done for climate change adaptation is, first of all, they've put adaptation front and center in their in their development policies. So when they talk about economic development and economic growth for their country, they're also in the same breath talking about adapting to climate change. And as they think about rural development, which in Rwanda is essential, 80% of the population lives in rural areas and are subsistence farmers. When they think about how to support development, economic development, create opportunities for some of these types of communities, they're doing it in the language of climate change adaptation. And this is a tool that in my book I talk about as mainstreaming, which is where you take the idea of a climate change adaptation policy and you integrate it into other policy streams so that it's not a standalone build a dike and keep the water out, but instead in Rwanda, for example, rural development strategies center around the creation of villages and moving disparate rural households into these identified and consolidated and government-built villages where they can access infrastructure, support, healthcare, schools, et cetera. Doing that, moving people into these villages, they're called model villages, is long-time rural development policy in that country. But it now also functions as a climate adaptation strategy, and they have prioritized what they call high-risk zones around the country as the first place where they should be relocating families away from high-risk zones, because now we're talking about climate change, into these same model villages where they've been moving families now for almost a decade to try to enhance rural life and provide opportunities for economic growth. So these are, you know, this is a very different setting from Amsterdam to go to Rwanda, but they're both examples of mainstreaming as a strategy for advancing climate change adaptation by embedding it in other policy streams that are funded, supported, and have political infrastructure and institutions already built around them. We don't have to start from scratch. We can use what's already there.
Really well said. That's good. All right, let's have a little fun. We're going
to
do a couple fun things. We're going to first give you a magic wand.
Uh-huh.
It's a special magic wand. You get to use it for one thing in the next year that I think, in your opinion, would have the most impact on climate change. How would you use the wand?
I would like to wave the wand over wealthy countries like the U.S. and Europe and tone down the vitriol and the anger and the moralizing. And I'd like us to, with my magic wand, also turn up cooperation and collaboration. I think we've drifted into a mode of communication, sometimes talking about climate change, that leads with anger. And the angriest people, I think, incorrectly often are from these wealthy countries. And we point to the fossil fuel companies and we say, you did this to us. And I don't think that's helpful. I think it's also inaccurate. We are the consumers of those fossil fuel companies. We are still the consumers. I'm the one who, you know, we're all the ones who enjoy having cheap gas prices at the pump, and we turn on the lights when we come home, and we turn on our air purifiers today. All of that is using fossil fuels. So I think demonizing is always dangerous. And in this case, in the case of climate change, dehumanizing and demonizing fossil fuel industries as being the bad guys is, I find it non-productive and awfully distracting. I would much rather work with industry as we try to tackle this problem that affects all of us.
Once again, a great use of the wand. That's such a lovely answer. Do you see that kind of anger, particularly at the COPs? I'm always impressed to hear people who actually are there. You see that there?
I do. I think the presence of that anger has bubbled up in some different ways over time. In the last few years at the COP, the angriest people are actually people coming from developing countries who feel like they desperately need support. Mm-hmm. And they're screaming into the wind, help us. Mm-hmm. Look at the situation we're in.
And they probably do desperately need
And I think they desperately
support.
Do. And that kind of anger I feel more comfortable with. I think that seems both appropriate and potentially useful because people hear them and pay attention.
It's a difficult concept. And I see the bridge even becoming a bigger gulf now between developing and developed countries.
That's right.
The developing did very little to create the problem. They often, as you say in Rwanda, they are very much bear the brunt of it more than anyone else.
That's right. And that's kind of at the heart of the, you know, climate justice movement is this inequity that you're pointing to. But I'm always really quick to point out and remind us that while it is true that the U.S. is a wealthy country by any measure, that's at the country scale. Within the U.S., as I'm sure you know, we have a significant poverty problem in this country. And we have communities and towns and individuals and households that are as poor as any you'll find in the developing world. And so we're a wealthy country. That doesn't mean we don't have critical climate adaptation impacts facing our impoverished communities and, in fact, all of us, and that we don't need to also be paying attention to adaptation here at home.
Well, thanks for the great use of your wand. Okay, now, one of the things we love to do, and you've just shared so much expertise and energy with us, we like to thank you for doing that. We want to plant a tree in a national forest in your name, in your honor, and out of respect for your time with us. Where would you plant that tree?
This is a lovely gimmick that you have. I think it's really great.
We're offended at gimmick, but go ahead.
But I think it's a great, nice thank you. And as you know, I lived in Colorado for a long time, and so I have lots of thoughts about which national forest I like the best. And I think I'll go with the Arapaho Roosevelt National Forest as the one I maybe spent the most time in. It's pretty close to the Front Range of Colorado, which is the main population center, and I have spent countless days hiking, backpacking, riding my bike in and around that national forest, and would love to see it have an additional tree.
Well, I believe we have some other trees already there, and what a great choice. Thank you.
Fantastic.
So much. Hey, one last question, or maybe two. Let's first talk about your work at Columbia. Columbia now is kind of coming into its forefront with its own climate school. Mm. Do you want to talk about kind of the purpose and maybe your role, or you know, what's going on at the Columbia Climate School?
Yeah, we're really excited. As far as I know, I think Columbia University is the first school in the U.S. to open a brand new school entirely devoted to the climate. And we're Columbia Climate School. We're the first new school at Columbia in decades. So it's been really quite exciting to start a new school. And I have the privilege of being in the right place at the right time and getting to be one of the inaugural faculty members at the Climate School. I think it really amplifies the depth and the range of science that's already going on at Columbia under the auspices primarily of the Earth Institute. So some of those institutional arrangements are now shifting and changing. But the Climate School will create and is already creating a hub for scientists from across the university to come together, share their knowledge, work together across disciplinary lines to research and contribute to solutions for what we face in climate change. So it's exciting. We have right now a master's degree program called Climate and Society at the Climate School. We are building and will migrate soon into an undergraduate degree program, a bachelor's degree, and in the future also hope to have a PhD degree available from the school. We're building those things now. So I teach in the Climate School. I teach in the undergraduate program in sustainable development, and I also teach in the master's program in climate and society.
Well, excellent. Anything else I haven't asked you? You want to tell anything fascinating you learned in preparing for your book, or anything you want to just leave us with? One last thought?
I don't think I have a last thought. I think this was a really useful discussion. I appreciate all the good questions.
Well, the book we've been talking about from Dr. Lisa Dale, Climate Change Adaptation, a wonderful book. I recommend you find it where you buy your books, Amazon, maybe your local bookstore, right?
Yep.
Anywhere.
Should
so thank you so much for your time today. Thanks for being
so
with
much,
us on
Tucker.
Path to Zero.
It.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us on your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to pathtozero@propane.com.